No Directions Gen Con Seminar Coverage. Designing Better Adventures, presented by Paizo. Special thanks to our Gen Con volunteers, Eric Brennan-Ives and Andrew Moore.
All right, so hello, everybody. Let's try that one more time, but in unison. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Okay, that was pretty rad. This is the Designing Better Adventures panel, and we'll start off with some introductions. I'm Adam Daigle. I'm Managing Developer.
I'm Robert G. McCrary, Starfinder Creative Lead.
And I am Linda Zeiss-Palmer. I develop for Pathfinder Society.
So yeah, we're all up here because we've worked heavily with adventures during our time as developers. Rob has probably been doing it longer than either of us, and Rob has been in charge of quite a number of adventure paths. And then I've...
A few modules. And now the Starfinder.
So I've got a couple of adventure paths under my belt right now.
And for me, good chunks of Season 7 and Season 8, and little bits of Season 6 of Pathfinder Society.
Lots and lots of adventures.
So, how should we do this?
You're the moderator.
That just means I call on people for questions.
Oh.
Yeah. You're the experienced one.
So, all the people in this room, raise your hand if you're looking to publish adventures professionally. Okay, got a few folks. And raise your hand if you're more looking to improve your adventures as a GM, just in general, for your home group. All right, that's helpful.
Good to know.
Because it is two kind of different skill sets. I mean, well, it's the same skill set, but sort of the end product and how you get there is maybe a little different, I would say.
And one, and one element of that is that just improving your adventures for your home game, a GM has way more flexibility than something going into print.
Yeah, that's the main thing. Is if you want to write for publication, it's not as much about what you want as what the publisher wants. If you're writing for your own group, it's what you want, and you can tailor and you can tailor it specifically to your group, to your players and their characters, which is not something you can do obviously writing for publication, because it needs to be able to work for a wide range of characters played by a wide range of people, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the particularly when you're looking for writing for your home group, but also when you're writing for publication, this is something that I really try to look for as a developer, is to have flexibility in the adventure to adapt to the PCs and their cockamamie schemes. And when they say, when you have the giant sign that says, go here, and they say, oh, let's run off into these woods over here, what's in these woods, that you have a way to work with that. In published adventures, there isn't quite as much flexibility with that. But in home adventures, you can definitely say, okay, well, I guess one of the principles of adventure design is not to over-prepare. So, like, if you spend hours lovingly detailing a village and then the PCs never go there, then you've wasted your time. But you can give a skeleton of a village, some of the main NPCs, and if the PCs never go there, they're the main NPCs in another village that they go to later, and nobody has to know. So it's good. It's good to do enough work that you have a solid backbone for a structure, but not so much that you're locking yourself into doing things in one particular way.
I know. Maybe we do want to talk about like sort of our individual design, like how we start.
Yeah.
Or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
You want to start with that?
No, you can.
Oh, sure.
I can start if you guys want to argue.
I'll start. That's fine. Obviously, everybody has their own things, and everybody kind of needs to find their own sort of process for this. What I tend to do is obviously first find sort of like what level range I want. And my first step is usually to go to the bestiaries and flip through and find what monsters that I either need or that I want. And especially now, you know, with Pathfinder, we've got 6 bestiaries out. It's easy to forget about some of them. And so I just like flip through and I'll just make a list in the proper CR range or possibly by terrain and everything until I have a whole bunch of list of monsters. And then I can kind of choose from that short list. But while I'm doing that, that gets me a lot of ideas, because if it's just like, oh, I forgot about this guy. What does he do? And I'll read about it, and something in their write-up will give me some cultural thing, or I'm like, oh, I could do this, this, and this. And so that's for me as I start with monsters, getting a list of monsters that I can use. And I do that even for writing my own stuff, but also for developing or outlining adventures for other people to write. When I'm outlining an adventure path, I'll go through and, particularly the last Pathfinder adventure path I did was Hell's Vengeance, where everyone plays evil characters. So that completely turns the whole paradigm on its head. So I had to go through all the bestiaries and find all of the good things that would be good foes. And so it's like, oh, yeah, unicorns, yeah, Pegasi, yeah, they never show up in adventures. So it's that kind of stuff, and that really helps, for me, get the juices flowing right off the bat. Starting with monsters. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for when I'm doing stuff to set up adventures for Pathfinder Society, which I suppose I've probably done more of than home jamming now at this point, where I like to start is with starting with thinking about where do the PCs begin and what things are important for them to have in the end. And sort of that, and then it's like, all right, so I've got point A and point B. How about how many, for Pathfinder Society, you really want to make sure that you're sticking to that 4 to 5 hour timeline. So it's like, okay, I have a structure here. I'm going to have two major encounters that are, generally see are appropriate and time consuming. They might be social, they might be combat. And then I'm going to have two minor encounters that are shorter than that. And I try both with Pathfinder Society Adventures and my home games to sort of have a blend of encounter types, because I find that players tend to get bored if you have like a giant chain of fight the thing in the room and then until it is dead, or like talk to these people and then talk to these people and talk to these people. So I like to keep things fresh within a single adventure, shake things up. There's a lot more flexibility when you're doing things for home games. I like to look at what the players have said about their characters. And if their character is just like, I'm a fighter, then I like to sort of go a little deeper into that. Okay, well, let's go a little bit into your story. Are you from this region? Or are you from far away? That kind of thing. And pull hooks out of the PC's backstories to use those to craft into the adventure. Because if you can come with the reason to have, like, one of the PC's relatives come in, or, the PC finds this intelligent item that is connected to something in their past or something like that. I mean, my players have learned that if you give me backstory, you'll get more goodies. So it's always fun to do that.
One of my starts, I also follow the Robert Curry school of going through and finding monsters, and sometimes that can, like, radically change what I intended by finding a monster you had forgotten about or a certain ability that they can do. But one of my starts is not even looking at a specific location, but thinking of, like, what kind of story do I want to tell, but more importantly, what kind of growth do I want to allow a character to achieve? Because whenever you build your characters, in your head, what they want to end up being. And this is something that you can do in your home games a lot easier, is, just ask your players what they see their character as at the end of it all, and kind of work things into the narrative that will help them develop and help them feel like they've achieved what they wanted to get to as a character.
With home games, too, I like to look at sort of what the strengths and weaknesses of the party are, so that you can have some of those encounters that are really knock down, drag out, because they're not like what the party is optimized against at all, and they really have to think about it sometimes. And then other times you have encounters where they're just going to breeze through it and they're going to get to show off their stuff. So varying the challenge is another thing I like to do in the design of adventures. And also thinking about ways to sort of put time pressure on sometimes. Because there can be a temptation to stop at the 15-minute adventuring day. You've done one encounter, then you go sleep, then you do another encounter, and then you go sleep. So if you can build in those things like, you can't necessarily just go rest now, then it lets you bring up the tension, even if the encounters themselves aren't as individually challenging. Or if you have other risks that there might be that are going on during an encounter, like, you're fighting these bad guys, but if you don't handle the fact that the roof is collapsing, then these innocent people aren't going to make it out of here, so what are you going to do?
I think another good tip, and this is really true for any kind of writing, they say if you want to write fiction, you should read fiction. If you want to write good adventures, you should read published adventures. And that's not just saying, buy our adventures. I mean, you should, because they're awesome. But, I mean, that's really, you can see how there's lots of different people that write adventures, lots of people have their own styles, and by seeing how they do it and how they build encounters, how they structure it together, particularly because it's for publication, even if you're not interested in it, it shows you a lot of their strengths, and you can kind of compare your stuff, like, well, I would do this, but they did that, why is that kind of thing, and just kind of get what's called, would be called like best practices and stuff, is seeing how they present that information, like what is important to present, what is maybe not so important, you know, because it's easy when you're kind of doing your own stuff that, particularly as a GM, you can kind of create this whole big backstories in your heads, and that's a lot of fun, and that can help a lot, but it can also be too much if only you're, of course, if you're getting enjoyment out of it too, why not, but if your players are never learning that, or you just don't want to sit there and read like a 3-page history to your players at the beginning normally, so you can kind of see how to work that into adventures, because there's usually a lot of backstory in published adventures, and it's like, well, how does that backstory get out to the players?
Yeah, we have a policy in Pathfinder Society, when you're looking at the adventure background, it's like, okay, unless there's a really, really, really good reason, it's not going to be over 500 words, and it's not going to contain information that at least isn't going to be helpful to the GM in understanding the context, that not going to contain information that the players could never possibly figure out.
And you can also look at even like adventures for other game systems too, even if they're completely different, just to sort of give you a sense of other types of things, other types of storytelling that you might be able to incorporate into your thing. Because I always have fun, because at first glance, you wouldn't think that, you know, if you look at a science fiction adventure that it would have something for complete fantasy, but you can just change a few things. You can, I mean, that's another good thing about reading adventures is you can, for your home game, you can steal parts of them. And nobody knows, your players don't know that you didn't do that. But, you know, you can bracket something that has already been written with stuff that you wrote, and that can help you craft, start with a piece and build off of that.
I was totally writing down, like, as y'all are saying things, I'm thinking about other stuff. And I had written too much backstory right as you were saying. But and then what Linda was saying also is about, you know, there's something to really keep in mind of will the PCs ever see that, which is kind of weird when writing adventures for publication, because you do have to tell the GM enough, but not too much.
Right.
It's also an easy hole to fall down into. One of my really good friends, who is also a writer, Brandon Hodge, he used to write these long, super huge backstories for his, like, not only for his characters, but for his campaigns that he was writing. And it just, like, it was almost like he was speaking, like, orating to us about the thing. And it's just like, I just want to stab an orc or something. Come on.
Yeah. And when you're doing a home campaign, not an adventure for publication, one of the things I like to do is leave a few of the mysteries of the story unspecified in the beginning, where there's a few different ways I could go with it, and then kind of decide as it goes on, which one do I think my PCs, this group of players, is going to have the most fun with? And occasionally with that, I find that what the answer ends up being isn't any of the answers I thought of in the beginning. It's something that some player just said sometime, like, well, you know, wouldn't it be ridiculous if the boss was really yada, yada, yada? And I'm thinking, that would be fun if you were right all along. So it's nice to have some flexibility there in what you're going to do.
Something else that helps with adventures is forcing difficult decisions. And not necessarily like anything grimdark or whatever, but give two options that the PCs really have to make a call of what they're going to get. And sometimes the value is obvious, but sometimes it's kind of close and they really have to think about it. And the difficulty with that is that sometimes you'll end up with the players all arguing for 2 hours of which of these two decisions they're going to make. And of course, you know, the typical player thing of just doing option R instead of A, B, or C.
That's one of the things that I like to do that kind of speaks to that a little bit is, if possible, when designing individual encounters in an adventure, is to have more than one way to solve that. It's certainly good in published stuff because, again, you have different groups. You may know that it's like, no matter what, my group is going to just kill these orcs. So if you know that, then there's no point in creating a diplomatic encounter. But you can, without too much extra work, for a lot of encounters, think about it, it's like, well, what if they don't fight? What if they handle it a different way? And plan for that. And that gives them to a certain extent, every adventure is a railroad because it's got a beginning and an end that the GM or the writer wants to take. And to a certain extent, the players have to agree to follow that path, unless you're doing a completely free-form campaign, but then you're not really writing adventures as much as writing a whole campaign, which is another point. But it's to think about, okay, they're on a railroad because they've got to get from A to B, but, you know, where do they sit? What car do they go into? Those are the kind of, what choices they make in terms of, do they fight? Do they, is there a diplomatic thing? Is it an obstacle that must be overcome instead of just a fight or something like that? It's varying it up. It's like Linda was saying about just not having room after room of fighting things. It can be room, that could be one way to solve that, is you just go through room by room and kill everybody. But what makes it interesting and what gives the players the feeling that their choices matter are the flexible options that they could try something else.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of what Rob was saying before about when people take different paths, if they take the diplomatic option, it's useful to think about who are the key NPCs in your adventure and what do they think of each other? Would any of them possibly team up? Would any of them possibly help with team up with the PCs against another NPC? Would they team up with each other against the PCs? How might that sort of work? And that sort of gives you a bit of a shape for that. Like, and another thing that I find is useful to think about, and this appears in every Pathfinder Society adventure for every creature, is what happens if somebody surrenders? You know, what do they do? How long are they willing to fight? Are they going to work with the PCs? Do they fight to the death? Which is, you know, sort of the standard, like, well, there's nothing else for it. This is like, you know, a cultist of some evil deity who just wants to get rid of you. Or are they someone who's like, okay, I'm down to half. Let's talk, guys. I'll tell you the secrets. That kind of thing.
You were scribbling down something there.
It's kind of a weird segue, but I was thinking more along the something I like to do in Adventure Paths. Since we have six pieces, a lot of that design is very important to structure each adventure, so you still have a climax, and then for the next one you still, you know, so you're building on going from boss to boss, sort of. One of the things I love doing that I think makes it a lot more rich is seeding something into the first adventure that is still relevant, maybe not necessarily in the second, but it pops up in the third and fifth again, or something that threads it through that may seem insignificant at one point, but then later on becomes more important because, you know, to have the players around the table have that, oh yeah, moment, mm-hmm. That's pretty rewarding. And I think, you know, as a player, that's really rewarding to see these things and go, oh, this is all connected, and it helps drive that narrative to its final conclusion.
That kind of speaks to what I would say is the beginning step that we kind of didn't even talk about, or what I think of as the beginning step is, what is it, how long is the adventure that you're trying to write? So are you writing a one-shot for your next week's game? Are you trying to do out a whole campaign? Do you just want something to be four or five sessions? Having that idea to begin with can help you structure so that you can put things in early that pay off later. And, you know, you don't have to even do it all at once if you're writing a bigger thing. You start off, and actually what I've found is the more stuff you kind of leave open allows you to react to your players and the actions they take. So you can have, like, sort of a general arc planned out, but you only really write the first two. And then as they go through and start making different choices, or they go to the forest instead of the village, mm-hmm. then you can manipulate your campaign to follow that thing. But having sort of a sense of exactly what you want, because it's obviously a lot different writing just a single four-hour session than mm-hmm. it is to, like, I want to write an entire adventure path type
yeah.
campaign. But they can both be rewarding in their own ways, but they have sort of different needs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we do have sort of overarching plots with the society, but it much more needs to be self-contained into the single adventure. Another thing I find useful is taking notes when the PCs take an uncommon degree of interest in something that you didn't expect them to. So, like, in my Kingmaker campaign, there was this guard whose name was Bob, because the PCs were just like, what's the name of this random guard over here? And I'm like, Bob? And I was just like, okay, so you're talking to this guard. And Bob ended up being through the entire campaign because they decided that, like, well, Bob is weak-willed, so you know he's the guard. It's like who's an absent-minded guard or whatever. And they're like, oh, we're gonna scry on him all the time and stuff like that. So it's like, all right, book six, Bob the guard is still relevant. Okay, Bob, you know you have to fill out your will say this time of day, right? Okay, yes, Your Majesty, and that kind of stuff. So you know, when they run with something, I've also learned never to give an NPC a flippant name like Bob because I know that my players are gonna have it bite me in the ass later on.
Yeah. Have a list of names. That's more GMing. But it's also good for writing, too. I mean, if you're writing it, you can plan that stuff out ahead of time.
Yeah, I've got, like, 3 pages of 3 columns of names that I have sitting next to my desk at work, and so whenever I need a name, it's just like, yep, that one, and I'll scratch it off the list.
I tend to like to look at the sample names for each ethnicity that we have and then think about, okay, well, what real-world ethnicities does it seem similar to? And look at some sample names from that and then try combining syllables until I get something that sounds right and then search it through all of our pre-existing adventures and see if we already have someone prominent called that, because then I'm not going to name them after the same person. But that tends to be a useful way that I find to name NPCs. And if I'm just doing it for home, I might just take real-world names, but try to shake things up a little more. Published adventures.
So we're about 20 minutes in. We can maybe turn the next half hour over into questions.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring up one topic.
Yeah,
bring up one topic first.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
No, that's good.
We can talk about, like, when we're writing adventures, where do we draw inspiration from? Where can people look for inspiration? Mm-hmm. Do you have anything, or do you want to think about it first?
I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, like, consuming media. Like,
not
necessarily movies as much, but, like, a lot of, like, TV shows kind of help in a weird way. Like Law and Order type stuff. Like, police procedurals are really weirdly inspirational as far as, like, telling a narrative. Because all you got to do is kind of reskin that idea, and it'll totally work. other bits, there's just, you know, like, stories and literature and, you know, short stories I've read. Some of those, you can take those general beats and the pacing of that narrative and do very similar things. Like, you know, when there's a certain climax of danger, it's like, okay, we'll replace this with an encounter against a certain monster instead. And it's pretty much like, yeah, reskinning existing narratives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty much a similar thing, looking at existing media, fantasy novels and fantasy novels, movies, TV shows, that kind of thing. I also draw inspiration for Adventures in Golaria and from looking through the things that we've said and thinking about, like, where are the little mysteries? Where are those little hooks? What can we pick up? Or wouldn't it be cool if we did something with this NPC? Another thing that John and I do is we look at the map of Golarion and we say, where haven't we been in a while? And what kind of stories can we tell there? What kinds of people have we not talked about? Who's been sort of kept in the shadows that we can pull out? And that using that sort of process helps, because I find that the hardest thing to do is just being like, write a story about something, and I just sit there forever. But if I can narrow it down to, okay, write a story that's for level 1 to 5 characters that takes place in Thuvia, then it's like, all right, now I have somewhere to start.
For me, I'm a big history geek, so I look at history a lot because, I mean, you can get character ideas from famous people in history. You can get, you know, obviously there's all sorts of big battles, and it works in a place like Galarian where you have a lot of nations that are loosely related to some real-world nations in some ways. You know, you can kind of see, well, what happened there, and how do I translate that? And so, I mean, obviously, movies and books and TV and all that kind of stuff does too, but just even, like, real-life situations, you know, from whether it's, like, a mad king who builds some crazy castle or something, I mean, that can literally be the foundation of an adventure. So it's just anything. It's kind of like, but look to what interests you, because then you're going to have the most fun writing in it, but also make sure that your players will be interested in that too. Because if you're the only one interested in it, your players might not have as much fun, I guess.
Also, dreams are really helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, your brain kind of already wrote the outline. You just have to fix it. Dreams work really well. I've used them quite a bit.
Cool. All right, now you want to do a question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, this is a pretty open-ended topic, so I'd love to hear what questions you have.
And it feels like the information y'all want would be a lot more tailored.
Yeah.
So we'll start there and then go back to you. All
right, so I've started trying to do my first adventure. It takes place kind of like crazy museum, all the stuff. It's kind of like Night at the Museum, except different, more adventure focused and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And mainly the thing I sent people to play test it, and I started to realize, wow, they have great ideas. They did these things in the GM that play tested it, did some fun things where it's like, oh, you want to recruit that thing? Sure. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that makes sense. That's cool. And like, I should put that in there. And they keep doing such a good job and doing an interesting run of it that I keep thinking, yeah, I should put that in there. And now I realize that I'm basically going to have to rewrite the entire module to fit in their playtest, playtest it again, and then someone else might do the same thing. So where do you kind of cut the line on like good ideas and things to put inside of a module?
Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to stop at some point. And there's no real solid answer to that. I mean, like, anyone who does anything creative runs into that wall of like, no, I know I can make this better. I know I can make this perfect. Having a deadline for publication is real good at
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you want to think about, too, you know, the more stuff you add to it, the longer it gets or that a GM would have to read, even if the length to play through it is the same. And so in some cases, it's like, well, do I need to write out this full thing as an encounter, or can I just kind of do like a bullet point list of, hey, here are some options just to give the GM guidance rather than hard coding that into the adventure? That's another way you can. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, those are really good ideas. I don't want to rewrite the whole encounter, but I can kind of say, here's some options and how to deal with them, perhaps.
A kind of line that I like to use often in society adventures where space can be a premium is something along the lines of, like, you know, if the PCs come up with another plan to hit, have a few different skill checks that they might do and provide a DCs and be like, sort of like, if the PCs come up with another plan to handle this, throw another skill check at about this DC at them. Mm. And sort of like, all right, well, you can roll with it. You know how challenging that's going to be. And sometimes they'll say something like, okay, it's about this DC if it's a common skill like perception or whatever. And if they have like profession exactly the thing we're doing right now, okay, DC minus 5.
I also want to point out, you mentioned something else which is really good, because you were like, oh, it's like Night at the Museum, but that's kind of like the elevator pitch. That's also a really good thing
yes.
to do at the beginning is, what is your one-sentence description of what the adventure is that you can just tell anybody, and they're all like, mm-hmm, I know exactly what that is. That can help you focus what you're trying to do so that you're not kind of writing all over the place. So that's another good thing.
Also, playtesting and listening to feedback is really important, so good job.
So something I've noticed over the past 2 years or so of GMing, and especially GMing adventure paths, is that numbers are not the answer for encounter balance. Because something I've noticed is that a lot of times I'll either be, things will be too pitiful to bother, or players will feel punished for specializing because, oh, I've got a plus 40 to this, well, the target is now 50s. And it would have been 30 if you only had a plus 20. So it doesn't feel like they're being rewarded for what they've done. It only feels like I'm punishing everyone else. So where do you kind of find that happy medium between making sure the people who pump the numbers are able to feel really good while still being challenged without making the other people who don't optimize as well feel like garbage?
Well,
and it's tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in terms of like the stuff that we do, that we have to kind of write for the middle ground, because that's where the most things, and we have to trust that GMs are going to have to modify it some to their, you know, because not everyone plays optimized. Some people like, and our philosophy is that most people kind of play down the middle and with a mixture of different players. If you're just writing for your group, you can adjust that because you know what those are. We have no way of knowing, but if we were to write a much harder adventure, then we have all these other people that are like, well, it's too hard. My players, yeah.
I do need it more in terms of, as a home GM writing an adventure, how I sort of tackle that problem with a mixed group where I have
okay.
people who sort of
well,
focus on the optimization.
Do these optimized people... Are there areas when they're optimized, are they sort of stronger than the other PCs across the board or only in certain areas?
Generally in the certain areas, but those certain areas do overlap some. Like in my Curse of the Crimson Throne campaign, I've got a Satori Grappler with a plus 46 to CMB and a Dirty Trick Vigilante with a plus 23 or something. So I can't really challenge the one without needlessly crippling the other, but just challenging the other, the Tatori is completely blowing it out of the water.
Well, Tatori's generally would be engaging with one foe at once, I imagine, so if you have a lot of foes that are spread out, then everyone needs to contribute. For example, I find that varying the encounter number, varying the terrain as well, sort of like, okay, well, you know, are there certain... This could also be one of those cases where it's useful to have sort of a secondary objective, like, okay, we need to get over to this, and we also need to... If you have a fight on two fronts, for example, and you know, like, all right, well, the story's going to go for that guy or whatever, and then they'll divide it up, then that can help. I mean, sometimes it also depends... It depends upon how you feel, and also depends upon how your players feel. Like, do the players of the non-Tatori characters feel short-sighted? Do they feel like they're being overshadowed?
Not so much as I feel like they are being overshadowed unnecessarily by the sheer weight of how big I have to pump these guys to challenge.
Have you talked to the Tatori player about his great skill at optimizing his numbers?
I have. We've had long conversations about it, and it's more to the extent of he's a very honest player. He doesn't like looking at bestiary entries. He doesn't know how high he should be targeting for, and he's terrified of if I only do a 30, what if we come up against something with a 60 CMD? Well, I can't do anything against that. And I can't really tell him, you're not going to be fighting Great Red Dwarf.
Well, I mean, yes. You can tell him that. You can tell him that, you know, you're at a level where you're pretty set against much anything.
More specifically, I don't feel comfortable saying, yeah, this is the target, this is the general number you should be targeting, because that feels like I'm giving him metagame knowledge, which doesn't... I hate that.
I would say something else that could help in some of this is going back to what Linda was saying about varying encounter types. If CMB is... And I know it can be any other number. It could be an AC or something like that. But typically, those are all combat-related. So something to, you know, throw a bone to someone else, like, you know, to the wizard or sorcerer in there, is throw in more skill-type things. Throw in, you know, bits that will, you know, like, he can win once, and that's fine, but give other people wins as well.
It comes down to what types of encounters do your other players enjoy the most as well. Like, does your vigilante like going into their social identity and stalking off and doing something? No? Okay.
No. All vigilante identity all the time. 7 charisma.
Okay, then.
No. This is where the specific problem comes in, because this is one where both characters have the overlap, and I can't really challenge one without crippling the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely recommend encounters with many creatures then, because then you have less of the challenge concentrated in one creature that's getting grappled and is never going to get out with those numbers.
Or just kill him.
I killed the last character, not for that exact reason, but there was a reason why I targeted him with Fantastic
Killer. Four over here, they're team kill him.
Let's go.
Yes.
Hi. One of my weaknesses as a GM is creating custom monsters. I mean, there's that whole monster creation section in the bestiary with targets to statistics for attacks and saves and so on. And that part is easy enough. But I find it difficult to judge how many additional abilities to give to the monsters after I've got those basics in place. And most of the time, I'm making monsters which are probably going to show up on screen once. Mm-hmm. And then either I've judged it wrong and they're totally overwhelming, or I've judged it wrong and they're totally underpowered.
So I'd recommend using as a starting point, especially if you're just going to do it once, using an existing monster as a starting point and retheming some of the things that they have, you giving them templates and things like that. That definitely helps out. Or you can give them for an existing monster some additional hit dice, and then they're like a special version of that monster. And when you're looking at the challenges of the DCs of the abilities, the chart in the back does have a sense of like what should the high DC be, what should the low DC be. It's useful to look at other monsters that same CR and see how many abilities they have, and also in terms of how well they face up against your PCs, like. A monster that has something that's really good against your PCs, like, I have a confusion aura because I'm a Sugathi, like, something like that, is going to be really, really nasty as an ability, whereas something that's more situational isn't going to be as challenging. One other thing you can consider doing when you're practicing this, and something that I did a bit when I was starting out as a GM, is if you get copies of your players' character sheets and you're really worried about your monster, you can run a mock combat, the PCs versus the monster, and see how it goes, and see if they go, if it's too easy or too hard. And after a few rounds, you can kind of get a sense of how that's going for those big ones.
I'll say two things. One tip you can do is just to reskin an existing monster. So you take the monster, James Jacobs, our creative director at Paizo, I was playing one of his games, and we fought this fungus queen, which has now been statted up. We were underground. It was not statted up, and we had no idea. It's like, oh, what is this fungus queen? What is it? And it was just a succubus. But he just, the story he told as we were playing it and everything, we thought this was this entirely new monster that he created up. That he had created from scratch and did not know that it was just a succubus, but there was just nothing succubus-like about it. So that's an easy way to get a new monster without actually having to create a new monster. Another guideline might be Pathfinder Unchained, which has a simplified monster system, which kind of tells you these are the sorts of abilities to give this type of creature. So it's a little more formulaic, and in fact, in Starfinder, that's what we're basing our monster creation system off, because it gives you a not just throw everything on. You can still go beyond the tables if you want to, if you really feel, but that does give you a little more structure for what sort of abilities or how many abilities a monster has than the rules in the bestiary, which are kind of just like, otherwise it's like Linda said,
yeah,
look at all other monsters and try to, because it is kind of an art. There's not really a hard and fast rule for how to do that.
And if a monster has a big strength, you want to make sure that a monster isn't good at everything. So like if its damage is good, then maybe its AC is bad, or maybe its will save is bad, and you know you have someone who can target that on your party. So that there's both something that it can bring to the table. It's like, oh wow, what was that? But also, there's a way to deal with it.
And to speak specifically about your talking about how many special abilities should it have, this goes back to you saying that you're only going to use it once. Likely, that time you used it once, it probably didn't make it past round five of the combat. So if it has five special abilities, it's probably not even going to use all of them before it's dead. So. Mm-hmm. The fewer, the better, and make sure that the ones it has, it actually needs. I've designed monsters that I had gave it special abilities that it probably didn't need. I probably could have cut half of them, and it still would have been perfectly usable.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yes?
I'm fairly new to DMing as well, but I've been writing for a long time, so I approached it very much from a writer's standpoint, and there's a lot of focus on story and stuff. But I've always been very into doing like the overarching storylines and complexities and stuff. What do you think about specifically filling holes, so to speak, in the character's backstory with stuff from your own campaign? Or like writing stuff, like things that they didn't know about the character, things they didn't know about their family or something, just kind of writing those in?
It depends upon the player. I mean, it would be worthwhile to have a conversation with them and make sure that they're on board with that, especially if it's going to be a revelation that's like, that you think that they might be like, oh, wait, no, that's not part of my character at all. I mean, it really depends upon knowing them. I've seen it go very well, and I've also seen it go poorly. So there's not really a one-size-fits-all answer to that.
Yeah, like, agency is one of the most important things that a player character has, and so any time that you diminish that agency, it needs to be something that was kind of, you know, talked about beforehand, or be prepared for whatever wiggly things might
come. The time that I saw it go really well is the player went to the GM, and the GM's like, okay, what's your character's backstory? And the player's like, amnesia. And then the GM's like, you know, if you tell me amnesia, I'm just going to come up with something, right? And the player's like, hit me. And then that time went really well, because the player definitely had buy-in too. Like, I will have whatever it was going on back here.
Isn't that the best part of Amnesiac Psychics?
This was a big deal with the Strange Aeons adventure path, because it starts off with all of the PCs not remembering the last 3 to 5-ish years of their past. And so you can still say that you're from Taldor and you know, your parents grew wheat. But what you were doing, which is what's important to the rest of the story, is something that the GM has a lot of control over. And I gave a lot of advice in the forwards to that about talking about, you know, getting the group together and kind of figuring a few things out, but leaving just enough open to change things around.
Also,
they're on to us.
I'll find your competition.
One thing about that too is it can be kind of dangerous being a writer, because if you're writing a story, you have complete control over the characters, and of course in an adventure, yeah, the protagonists are not under your control.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so one way is kind of turn on its head is, well, what can you take from their backstories? Because it's also really good because you know how to tell a story and how to do these big overarching, yeah, plots, but it might be easier to look at their backstories and see what from their backstories can you incorporate into your story, because they're the ones who are making the decisions about what the characters are actually doing.
Yeah, that's usually what I've done thus far. And,
yeah,
and it's also kind of caused a problem a little bit, because I've had people who have said, like, you should turn that campaign into a story. And I'm like, it was written without a main character. Like, it's really hard to say, you know, to write characters for something that was originally designed not to have a main character, because it's just plopping these players in there.
Right, right.
It can be useful too to take the bits, to work with the players to explore parts of their backstory more too. So, you know, if you only know a few facts about, like, some character's sister, but you know that, like, he's close with his sister or whatever, just sort of having the sister come by and visit and seeing how the PC reacts and using that to build on it, sort of as a collaborative experience, rather than saying, this is how this is going to be.
So we have, you know, we'll go there, and then next, and then next.
Yeah. So one of my main weaknesses as a GM is figuring out how long things are going to take.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And so I guess my question is, what's, especially for you, with Pathfinder Society and everything, what are good ways to get a solid estimate and feel for how long things are actually going to take between social encounters that end up being more in-depth than you expected to combats that are over and around, and
mm-hmm.
trying to fit that into a session that was planned to be like 3 hours?
So we do a few things. First of all, in Pathfinder Society, we like to have optional encounters, which can be cut if there's not enough time, that don't really bear load in the story, because some things are going to flex one way or another. We look at a few things. We look at the CR of the encounter, for sure. We have guidelines for each tier of, in general, what CR is going to be considered to be a major encounter versus a minor encounter. Those are sort of like specific numbers where we'll say, okay, you know, for example, for tier 1 to 5, a CR 4 or 7 encounter is going to be a major encounter. It's going to be the big boss, and we're going to count that as a major encounter. A CR 3 to 6 is probably going to count as a major encounter, whereas a CR 2 to 5 is going to be a minor encounter. But by that I mean like 2 for the 1/2s and 5 for the 4/5s is going to be a minor encounter. We also look at what kind of abilities do the monsters have. Do they have, because when you start bringing in things like entangle, web, confusion, any of those types of things that just, those kinds of things extend the length of encounters dramatically. Versus if you have something that's more like, all right, you know, I'm beat stick and I've got my pile of hit points and I got my pile of damage, that's probably not going to take as long. Terrain factors too, difficult terrain makes things take longer, larger rooms make things take longer. So we generally look at we generally look at it in that sort of paradigm, and then say, okay, well, how many things are going to make this take longer? With social encounters, those are a lot more flexible, because it really depends upon the PC. Usually a basic social encounter we would count as just like a quick little minor thing. Whereas if it's going to go into like the influence subsystem. Like, then you've got a subsystem. If there's a subsystem, we always consider that to be a major encounter, because that's gonna expand out, and that's gonna take more time as people get a feel for it. Investigations, we always treat as major encounters, because you never know how long it's gonna take, and you never know how many rabbit holes and red herrings people are gonna go down. So I would say generally look at how challenging it is relative to the abilities you expect for your PCs. Budget in a little extra time, and if you can, have something that's optional. that you can pull out if you find. And we try to put the optional encounters near the end, too. So it's like, all right, if you've got less than 90 minutes remaining, you don't need to do this encounter. So in terms of not load-bearing, you know, usually those they don't have treasure. They don't have, because we don't do XP in Pathfinder Society in the same way. They don't have treasure. They're not really required. You can just walk into the room and these things will be dead, and it doesn't make a huge difference. But it's an extra challenge for the people who breeze through. Welcome.
Who's next? It was you?
Yeah.
So one problem I've had, both as a GM and like just like witnessed as a player, has been like the contrarian character, which is like no matter how many plot hooks you give them or, you know, what you do, they will like almost on purpose just ignore them and go the other way, just as a matter of principle. Like, you can have a dragon attacking a town, you can have, you know, the king send them a letter personally requesting their audience. They won't do either. They're going to go into the woods where nothing is happening.
And is this one player, and everyone else is moving along with the story, or?
Most of the time, but sometimes there's, like, it gets contagious.
Does this human play that same type of character each time?
Regularly.
Okay, that's a human problem.
But not, like, there have been other times where it's just been that character. Like, they've just gotten really into character with that character.
I mean, there's no way you're going to be able to write an adventure for that person. I mean, the only thing this gets into, like you said, it's a human problem, and GMing and having a discussion and like, look, I'm spending this time writing these adventures. It's obvious you're supposed to go to the village to save it from the dragon. If you don't want to do that, is this, I mean, and I don't want to tell people to kick people out of their games or anything, but sometimes you do have to think about that so that everybody else is having fun. Like, one person shouldn't be able to derail it for everyone else. And
I mean, you could also trick them.
Yeah. Related
be
to
like,
that.
Hey, there's something cool happening over here. Now I'll go over there, and that's what you really have planned.
Maybe a more specific example would be like, for instance, there's a social encounter. This player has, you know, doesn't find social encounters interesting at all. They just want to hit stuff. And so, rather than just, you know, standing at the back of the group while it's happening, they'll purposely interject to make things more awful.
Well, there is always the possibility, if you know you're running something that one of your players doesn't like but everyone else likes, like a complicated puzzle I did once, or like a complicated social encounter, there's always the possibility of being like, okay, you know, dude, I know you really don't like this kind of thing, so we'll be sure to stop the social encounter. When the social encounter ends, we'll be done with the session, and then we'll pick up next time, if you really have that sort of thing coming up. But yeah, if someone is being continually disruptive, that is something to talk to them about. And when everyone's getting on the bandwagon, that's more like, okay, well, the group wants to see this happen, and that's more of a the group wants to do something else, which isn't really as much of an issue. But it also depends on how your other players feel about this player's behavior, and if they are getting frustrated with it, and if it's causing tension at the table. Because the more that's happening, the more it's sort of like, as a GM, it's good to go ahead and address that right away before it drives a wedge in your group.
That doesn't really seem to be, like, frustrating other players so much as it's just, like, derailing things for an extra hour every session.
Is it are there consistent things that his character is driving toward, or is it just, like, not whatever you planned? Is his character driving toward consistent things like, I want to keep going into the woods all the time? Or is it just not whatever you've planned?
Sometimes just not whatever I planned.
So it's not something that you could just say, oh, his character likes the woods, let's do a woods adventure and get that out of the system? Okay, yeah.
Sounds like something
you
can build out of game.
Yeah, that's... I've given all the game advice I can then. It's a person issue.
The balance of narrative and player agency, you guys mentioned for home groups, hook people with the backstory. What do you guys do when you don't have that knowledge of the player's backstory in your published material?
So a big thing that we do in the Pathfinder Adventure Paths at least is the campaign traits, you know, which are those extra things that provide a hook for every character for the campaign while giving them a little mechanical benefit. The Pathfinder Society has that you're all members of the Pathfinder Society.
Yes.
So that has the built-in hook. That can be any sort of, you can kind of steal that for, in Starfinder we have like, well, the assumption is you're all the crew of a starship. So you're going to be doing certain things together. Even something as simple as like just the skeleton of an organization that they can be members of can provide an automatic hook. And sometimes, I mean, you know, it depends on the group, but you don't always need a hook. It can just be like, you guys want to playing adventurers, we're playing Pathfinder, right? So you're in a bar. I mean, you can go and just look for adventure or just something that's or ask, you know, when they're making up their characters. You could, even if they don't want to do full backstories, just say like, what are three things your character is interested in, or what's one thing your character loves and one thing your character hates? And that can give you just enough of a hook maybe to craft something for those people.
And if they don't know, but you know that there's something that could be interesting, like, hey, you know, if somebody here is from the town of Hollowhaven and like is well known there, then the PCs will get extra advantages later on and everyone there will like them or whatever. Especially if it's like something that's positive, that's like, hey, maybe you're from over here, and then they can get benefits later on for having chosen that. Then that can sort of be a way to bring them in, particularly for like the Shire players. I find that like if there are times when they shine in particular and they don't necessarily have to say that much, but they can still be like the star, then that's good.
Yeah, I have two questions, but I'll say another one for later. I'm a relatively new DM, but I've been told that I do a really good job at both writing story and with interesting NPCs. So my first question was, what do you think about like mixing in some funny moments with some very serious ones? For example, I have a plot revolving around this group of people who do a lot of really bad things that the PCs are going against, and so I split up the story between them dealing with the aftermath of what those guys have done and setting up a date for two romantically inept NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it bounces back between those two kinds of styles.
Comic relief is a trope for a reason.
Yeah.
Varying types of encounters and varying narrative are, I would say, the same.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps it from being stale or boring or the same, or not boring as in it's bad, but just the same, you know.
And that's one of the reasons that I said, like, where I try to, in adventures pass, you know, for public stuff, that I try to have different ways, because I'd also get through an encounter, because then the GM can also decide to take with that. Because if I say, well, they could fight or they can do diplomatic, that can spur the GM to think, well, I'm going to manipulate this encounter just a little bit to do this one way. And so I think as long as your players are good with it, any sort of flexibility or changing back and forth to provide different flavors can be really rewarding.
Yeah, the player that was doing that was having way too much fun with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back there.
One thing I was wondering, again, you've mentioned it a few times with varying encounter types, is just advice on non-combat encounters, because combat's fairly easy to plan. You grab some monsters, you make a map, you plop the players in and wait until one side quits, but it's a lot harder for me to figure out how to plan non-combat encounters.
So you have, I started to think about, you have investigative encounters where you're trying to find out a certain, you know, solve a mystery or something like that, and you also have sort of like intrigue social type encounters are two of the bigger categories that I would think of. Do your players generally show interest in engaging with NPCs when they appear?
Yeah, they usually do.
Yeah. So I would say investigations. My tips for those would be that for everything you need the PCs to find out in an investigation, make sure that you have three clues that can get them there. And because when you're going with a combat encounter, it's a lot more scripted in many ways. You're in a room and there's something and you got to fight it and hit it with a stick until it's dead. Whereas when you're talking to people or you're investigating something, it's a lot more free form. So I find it useful for NPCs when I'm thinking of a more social encounter, think about, okay, you know, who are they? What's their name? What do they look like? What are a few distinguishing personality characteristics? Because once you start getting a few NPCs in a room and you're trying to portray all of them, it's all going to become a muddled mess if you don't have a way to sort of distinguish them from each other. And What do they want to get? Why are they talking to the PCs? What do they want to get out of talking to the PCs? Are they initially you know, kind of suspicious or hostile to the PCs? Are they looking to help the PCs? If they're looking to help the PCs, why are they looking to help the PCs? So, I mean, it really depends upon your setting too, like where these NPCs are going to be. What kind of setting are you looking at here?
It's mostly kind of like your regular fantasy setting. We've thrown in, there's like, it's basically like way before the session campaign, like hundreds of years. It used to be high tech. Everything got destroyed, and now it's generic fantasy stuff. So That's the general setting.
Yeah. So, did you guys have some thoughts on that as well?
I think you covered that pretty well.
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, remember, traps are all not combat encounters. They're pretty easy, and it doesn't always have to be like, oh, it's a pit or a blade. Like, there can be more interesting things. Hazards, which involve more like skill checks and everything, and obviously then you want to look at what the players have or what the characters have, so that some people aren't really like, well, if you have to make a really high climb check and, you know, the wizard does not have a good climb, that's not a good way, unless there's another way for the other characters to help. But it's just, it's looking for things. If you can look for things that play to the strengths of one or two characters, and then kind of like, well, if they can help everybody out, then that becomes a non-combat encounter. They need to figure out what's the best way, you know, who's the best person to take point on this and can bring everyone else through.
And a social encounter doesn't have to be like a big complicated dinner party with 100 people. It can just be talking to one NPC for a while. Or it can just be like, you know, something that gives the PCs a chance to talk among themselves, or a cause for discussion, or like we were talking about before, you know, a decision that they need to make.
We're actually at like 5 till.
Oh, we are?
So we should be clearing out for the next thing.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
So sorry for all those hands that just went up. But thank you all for coming.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for coming.